Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination, Extra Blooms Edition. These Extra Blooms episodes are revisits of our past guest. My co-producer, Angela Washington, and I very often find ourselves sharing updates with each other. Oh gosh, did you see what that guest was up to? Did you see what they did? Did you see that? Did you see that? And we figured that if we get excited seeing what new things they're accomplishing, that you might too. So these Extra Blooms editions are that, a little extra, where we revisit with a past guest to see what else has gone on since last we spoke. Maybe they've got a new passion project, a new idea, a new book, a new accomplishment, and we like to share that. So feel free to go to themorninggloryproject.com to listen to any previously aired episode. And we love it if you write a comment, share it out, give us a review, and let others know. Of course, you can always subscribe to The Morning Glory Project across all of the podcasting platforms. That way you just never miss an episode. So welcome to The Morning Glory Project. I'm glad you're here today, and I know that you'll love hearing from our Extra Bloom guest. I'm honored to have my friend and colleague Leah Lacks return to The Morning Glory Project for this Extra Blooms episode. When Leah Lacks was asked to write an opera to celebrate local immigrants, she began by spending a year listening to the stories of upheaval, migration, and arrival. They told her in confidence their stories. She felt that she had discovered the song of America, found its great beating heart. But Leah also discovered troubling truths about America through the eyes of immigrants, and in so doing was inspired to uncover the lost history of her own Jewish family and their immigration story. Throughout this interwoven experience, their stories and hers, Leah found not only a larger context for the story of immigrants, but a new way of looking at her own identity, rather than as a member of a very small minority, but as a part of a very large majority who are in this country because either they or their parents immigrated from another country. Nearly two decades after Leah had those conversations, long after the opera she wrote had left the stage, she captured those stories into this libretto of a story. Her extraordinary new book, Not From Here, The Song of America. Leah was a guest on the Morning Glory Project after her deeply stirring memoir, Uncovering How I Left Hasidic Life and Finally Came Home, which is the first gay memoir ever to come out of the Jewish ultra-Orthodox world. Leah's dual career as an author and as a librettist has brought her many well-deserved accolades, and when she's not writing, you can find her playing cello or kayaking around the world with her wife. Leah, thank you so much for coming back to the Morning Glory Project. I'm so pleased to have you.
Oh, Betsy, I love being here, and I'm thrilled to be back.
So first of all, for those of us who didn't grow up with or have not cultivated a full experience or understanding of opera, can you tell us what a librettist is and what you do? Just give us the Cliff's Notes so we know what we're talking about.
I just want to open with, I got the opportunity to write that libretto that changed my whole life by Houston Grand Opera. And this was a major production. This research that eventually resulted in this book was a major production that was broadcast nationally on NPR and big review in New York Times when I didn't know the answer to your question at the time.
Oh, good. So we don't have to feel like schlubs for not knowing.
I'll never really understand why I got that commission, but I was handheld and walked through the process. And at the same time, given enormous creative leeway to find the words that I wanted to put down on the page. A libretto is a combination of a play and a poem that's very specialized because there are sounds and vowels that are much better for singing than others. And we want to emphasize those. And because it gives the shape not only to this specialized play, you know, drama, arc, narrative arc, peak of crisis, and, you know, all the things that we know for fiction, but it also gives a shape to music. And I guess we were all lucky because I had no idea I could do it. But when I started writing the libretto, I was imagining music. I realized that I always hear everyone's voice as music, that I hear the sounds around us in society as the music of America, the music of our society or in any group. And so I sort of intuitively built in the things like the pacing, the rhythm, the legato or staccato kind of comes into the words. And the composer beats out the rhythm of the words, and it very much helps to shape the, they're not bound to it, but it very much helps to shape the music. I also had to imagine any conversation, you know, or interaction between two people or three people as an ensemble. So it becomes a duet or a trio. And I imagine the sounds of behind them or the story behind them as the chorus, in much the way the Greeks imagined that as a chorus on the stage.
So you didn't write the music itself per se, but the story and the...
Oh God, no.
You say, oh God, no, but of course you're a cellist and you are a musician, but that's a whole different deal.
Right. Being a composer is very specialized and it's always the primary, right? I always say it's my job to make the composer cry and to give him a structure to hang his beautiful music on. And that's all.
Oh, your job is to make a composer cry.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful job. Well, I've described to you my experience, and really it's my experience of both of your books, of Uncovered, which still lingers in my heart these several years after I read it. And now with Not From Here, I call this book Beautiful, Horrible, Beautiful, because it is beautiful art, the book. It is beautifully written, but it illuminates some truly horrible truths, not only about what an immigrant suffers in his or her or their own country or location and what causes them to leave that, but the not so perfect, not so beautiful experience of coming to this country. Now, it also should be said that that Houston is a player in this story as well, that you wrote this for the Houston Opera. And I didn't know, because I don't know Houston, I didn't know that Houston was such a cosmopolitan city that's made up of so many immigrants. I was ignorant of that fact until reading your book. So the city of Houston is the hub in which all the spokes of these immigrants come in, and you began these interviews. You were newly out of your own Hasidic life when you began these interviews. Is that right? Am I doing the math right?
About 2 years out, yeah, that's all. I didn't feel integrated into the society. I was catch my breath and figure out where I'd landed.
Well, doesn't that seem like a parallel to exactly what the immigrant experience, even though you didn't geographically immigrate from another country, it seems like there are such strong parallels between your own reentry or into mainstream American life as opposed to Hasidic life, what an immigrant might go through too, in terms of that feeling of not from here.
Oh, that's a funny thing, because it was so recent that I didn't even know why these stories and the people that I met compelled me so very much. And so that the answer to your question is part of the journey of the book, the realization that I was in a way an immigrant into my own society, the realization that virtually any American, you can tap them on the shoulder and say, and where are you people from, your people from? And, you know, they might have to go back a few generations. But everybody had gone through this sense of where have I landed and what do I do next? I gradually came to deeply relate to the people that I met. And as I talked about figuring it out and making their way into this complicated society, they became my teachers. I felt like I could follow them. Not only did they define our nation in a way that is usually done on the page, but I figured I could follow them in a way, their resilience and their determination and their great love of this country, open-eyed despite its problems. Maybe I could follow them more assuredly into America.
So you sat with people who were from various countries around the world. From why don't you tell me the basic groups that you spoke with, the countries or the families from the countries from which the families and individuals you interviewed came.
Well, let's just say they were from every continent and many countries. I focused initially on the five groups in the city that had the largest population, and that would be people from Nigeria, from Vietnam, from a combination of Pakistan and India, from Central and South America. Mm-hmm. But I actually interviewed many more people than that. As you page through the book, because it focuses on seven of the most outstanding stories I've ever come across, and everyone blew me away. But in between those stories, I wanted to give you a sense of what it is to walk down the street in this city, especially, well, anywhere in this city, what it is to be here. And so I collected from all those other interviews that I don't have the whole story in the book. I collected blow you away, you can't make this shit up kind of standout quotes. Right. And each one is from a different country so that you have a sense of, you know, we aren't divided by community here. We all live among one another, and everyone you meet seems to be in their areas where everyone you meet seems to be from somewhere else. Mm.
Well, of course, it should be said that, but for those indigenous people, everybody's ancestors in this country came from somewhere else for another reason.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't put it in the book, but it sparked me to discover the indigenous history of this area. It was pretty much genocide.
Of course.
So it just deepened the irony of the whole story.
Well, there are two directions I kind of want to go in this conversation. And one is, there's this ironic marriage in the book between patriotism and appreciation for what is here, what is glorious about this country, and what is the myth and falseness about what we think about the goodness and some of the really ugly, nasty, horrible things that we put immigrants through, that we create for ourselves. That duality of, and in the past, let's see, we're recording this in 2024 in February, in an election year that's followed a number of years of turmoil and craziness in our American life. And that duality of my own patriotism and appreciation and deep gratitude for what opportunities exist here for people, for women, for people that come from other cultures. And then at the same time, this, my disgust at some of how we behave on this planet toward other people. Can you say a little bit about that duality?
Absolutely. My line about the book is that I saw the American dream as a very tarnished thing. And I came across this kind of patriotism that, was so glowing that it was embarrassing to me. I said, I have met the American dream, and it speaks with an accent. Mm. And I think perhaps it always has. Mm. When people leave a much worse situation and come here, they're fine with our problems, or they don't focus on those. They expect there to be problems and imperfections. They're just happy that they can find a job, and when they get a job, they always get a paycheck, and they can find a house and or an apartment or a place to live, and there's always shelter. That blows them away. Not everybody. I mean, you know, lots of people come here already of better means, but nobody leaves everything and comes here without having loss that they leave behind. About 20 or 30, I'd say, interviews into the project, I looked up and realized that almost every single person of these people that I had met at random who agreed to be interviewed had run away from war. Mm. And we're talking all over the world. And then I looked a little closer and I went, oh no, oh God, they all ran away from wars that the United States either paid for or fed by sending military guides, equipment, all kinds of things, or actually participated in.
What a bizarre twist of irony that is, you know, that that people end up wanting to come to this country that in small, medium, or very large part contributed to the agony that caused them to want to leave their home.
You know, when I think of irony, I think of it as an accidental coalescence of opposites. But in this case, the United States made it policy that in those areas, specifically those areas that we're involved in, apparently people were granted entry into this country as refugees. Hmm. And maybe it was appeasement. I don't know. I mean, it, obviously only a tiny, tiny minority of the people who lost their homes, whose society and community and families were upended, who saw death and destruction, who ran away with nothing. Only a tiny percentage of those were here. And, you know, I was finding representatives of that tiny percentage, but the irony hit me very strongly. When Houston Grand Opera decided to take the Vietnamese movement to a Vietnamese community center.
Meaning the Vietnamese movement of your opera.
I'm sorry, of the opera. Yeah, the yes. Music. The core of that movement was singing what had once been the anthem of South Vietnam. You know, that the U.S. attempted to support, that South Vietnam doesn't exist anymore because the North won and the communists took over. So that anthem is forbidden in South Vietnam today. And in opera, Ryan McKinney sang the anthem. He was taught the Vietnamese, but the composer slowed it down to half tempo. So he sang it in this deep, sonorous, mournful baritone, and it came out like an elegy. And people started to stand up and put their hand over their heart. It was one of the most moving things I've ever seen. And I thought, you know, look at the yearning that they have brought with them that will never go away. And here the Vietnamese community was running from a war that we failed. We left them. We failed. And then before we failed, we participated in an enormous amount of the destruction of that tiny country. And they are still suffering from it. People are still dying from our destruction there to this day. How complicated they must feel about this country. And yet they can acknowledge the love. We have to do that. I have to do that. I thought, I have to love even when I see the failings. I have to know how to find survival even when I feel that I can't. I have to accept the contradictions and things. And yet at the same time, I felt like we may never find our way out of this music.
Hmm. Well, in addition to the seven main stories that you tell in the book, you have it, the book is laid out like, I suppose, a libretto might be, in that it has intermezzos. And those intermezzos are just little snippets and quotes from other people, or some of the same people, I imagine, that are just commentary about what they feel about being here or what they've overcome. And I found myself rereading those, because they're very short, but I found myself rereading them and imagining my own grandfather's immigration. And I just remember my grandfather immigrated from Italy not too long after the turn of the century, and not this century, the last one. And I remember telling him as a high schooler that I really wanted to go to Italy. You know, I really wanted to go to where he'd grown up. And he says, "Oh, why do you want to go there? It's dirty. This is beautiful here." He didn't understand, because he had left suffering and poverty. Mm-hmm. And those things. So as I read those little snippets, those little intermezzo moments in your story, I thought of how immigrants must, how they were able to sort of, in a very little quick bite of a thought, and how you were able to capture it, of course, communicate such big feelings. Like my grandfather saying, "It's beautiful here. Why would you want to go there?" And them saying, he said, "We starved there. We didn't have shoes there." this is good. You stay here. You stay here where it's nice, he said. And I found myself connecting. So, of course, then the other branch of conversation I want to have with you is that you indeed thought about your own family's history as, I don't know whether it was as you were interviewing these or in reflection afterward, but you discovering or getting a closer view of your own family's history. Can you say a bit about that journey that you took?
I'm glad you segued in that way from the picture of the community into my own story, because those little bits give you a much broader range of like emotion. You know, there's lots of opportunities to laugh out loud. Or there's poignance too. The little boy from Nigeria who said, "No, of course I don't miss Africa, but all the time I want to sing our songs from home." Or the Mexican man, a young man who said, "Mom learned English watching Mr. Rogers. He talked so slow and clear. She cried when he died." You know, they're the, like wonderful moments of adjusting to American culture and grabbing onto it as a survival and always looking forward, always looking forward. Or the Russian man who said, the social worker offered me a sofa, but sofa is a nickname for Sophia, for a Russian name. And I said to her, "Why do I want sofa when I have my wife?"
Yes, those little bits of humor, of lost in translation moments, coupled with the poignancy of, I want to sing the songs from back home. That's why I found myself reading and rereading those.
And that's why they're part of why I began to feel like the fact that the origin stories of transition to this country are lost in my family, because my grandparents, who I knew very, very well and practically grew up in their lap, would never, ever talk at all. When I got into my teens and I really queried my grandmother, she said, "Well, some of those people I don't like. And if I don't like them, then I forget about them." It's like that. I could not never get a word, none of us, which meant that it told me that even if I went and found, you know, the larger picture of the movement, I wouldn't get these moments of what it was like to be in this country when they're first here, where they find humor and struggle to survive all at the same time, when they're hopeful but struggling. You know, I always look at that intersection of opposites like that. That's what makes us human. Hmm. You know, whenever you describe a character in writing, you can't just say, you know, he was strong. You could say he was strong, but let me tell you his weakness. You know, that's what makes him human. Hmm. I wanted that. And so it was a segue, yeah. And I did go and start looking seriously into my family's journey to this country. It was quite a powerful thing. I think in adolescence, I was always wondering who am I? Because by the second generation, me, I hadn't inherited a history, but I, as a Jewish person in Texas, and you know, I didn't feel I quite belonged either. So where do I belong? There was definite anti-Semitism around me. It's not a thing of the past. It's not a thing of World War II. It's always simmering, that it will always bubble up at certain times in history.
Well, I was also really touched, as I mentioned in the introduction here, that what came through the story too was this notion that you had viewed yourself as this tiny little minority, 2% of the country, you know, is Jewish, right? If I'm doing the math, if I'm remembering your math right, that 2% of the country is Jewish, and that made you a teeny minority, but that you found yourself in it's as if the rivers of immigrants merge and become a giant population of immigrants, of which you now consider yourself a part, immigrants or their next generations, that makes you the larger part. The majority in this country is people who either have come here or whose parents came here.
Or who are descended from, I would say.
Or who descended from there. So becoming kind of part of the larger picture.
Yeah, we are a nation of immigrants. And I have to point out, because I went and looked into this too, immigration is a very conscious government policy. It's always a flow that they that the Department of the Census Bureau and I guess various financial, you know, economists look at. Because it's always been used to simulate the economy. I looked at the front page of the 2020 census, and the four-line summary said population growth is flat. That's a given that that's a downer for the economy. And it said the only way to address this is to increase immigration.
Which is so peculiar, because I think that what we hear from the more conservative side of our country is that immigrants are a weight on us. They cost us money. We have to pay for their school. They're a drag on the economy. And it's exactly the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's a ploy to power. It is absolutely a ploy, because once they get into place, they'll make big public gestures. But policy is policy. You know, you can't really shut it down or it's going to hurt the economy. The other thing I found was that pretty much the same number of people have come into this country illegally every year for many years. I would say without papers, I would put it that way, regardless of when there was a wall, when there wasn't a wall, when there was Border Patrol, when there wasn't, when it was Democratic, when it was Republican, the same, about a million people have been flowing into here no matter what, every single year, every year.
So it's just the degree of the kerfuffle that gets raised about it in the political dialogue that changes.
Play on people's emotions.
The fear of the other is always one of the cheapest ploys, isn't it?
That's why my family's here. What's left of them. Yeah.
Well, I guess, yes, of course. And I guess I was thinking of it as that in this country, to make us afraid of them, the caravan that's going to come over, those people that aren't like us, they're going to come and take and ruin and whatever. We have to fear them, as opposed to, wait a minute, they're going to add to this, I won't say melting pot, because that's a big fat myth, but to this stew that is us all, that is, has separate and together in it, in the same soup, to see it as a benefit. The stories that you've told, so this is 20 years since you've written them. I'm curious if you've remained in touch or have followed up on any or all of your subjects since that time, and if you know anything about them.
There are two in the book, the woman from the former USSR and the woman from El Salvador. I'm not able to be in touch with. One was and has to remain anonymous, and she disappeared to escape immigration after the opera. Although we translated the libretto into Spanish for her and privately escorted her in. And then she was gone. The other woman, it was interesting to me, the woman from the former USSR, I felt that she had never, what she did is she, instead of ever integrating into this country, she went and immersed in a very ultra-religious community so that she could sort of perch in the U.S., but had never, it was clear to me, she had never integrated. And in recent years, she moved to Israel. So, I don't have any contact with her. The other people I've all kept in very close contact. Yes.
Well, I don't want to spoil any of the stories, specific stories in the book by revealing them here. The book is just launching now. This is, this will air in April of 2024, and the book is just arriving on the scene. And I so recommend both of your books, and really I see them as interwoven. These two stories, that you will be in good company if you find Uncovered and Not From Here by Leah Lax. And let it also, there's one more thing I want to touch on before we close, and that is an immigrant's story. It seems necessarily to do with struggle, because they wouldn't be immigrating. I mean, but for those with high means and whatever, you know, the kinds of immigrants that you were interviewing here are coming from struggle, but there are differences between the genders and sexuality issues of those that come in too, and that the women in the story are assaulted in ways that sometimes the men are not, and the men are burdened in ways that the women are not. Both terrible, both, and I don't know what to say about that other than just to say that it cannot be unnoticed in the stories as well.
It was extremely important to me to have equal representation of men and women and to have children speaking as well. Mm-hmm. If this book does anything in the course of reading it, I hope the reader comes to understand that it's a collection. There's no such thing as immigration, and it's completely wrong to call it an issue. It's a collection of individuals, and each have their story. It's a human migration is since the beginning of time. We have to know how to deal with it, not try to deny it, and see every single person as having their own story.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for writing this book, for writing that libretto. I would somehow love to hear it someday. I would hope that it could be resurrected somehow. And I also know that your book Uncovered was produced as an opera as well. And so I will hope for the time that I can, with my opera ignorant ears, I can enjoy that music, because I know that I would. Thank you for your courage and your creativity and your tenacity in writing these stories, and for gracing me again with this conversation.
Thank you, Betsy.
My conversation with Leah Lacks today, and really my reading of both of her books, how do I say this without sounding lofty? I feel changed by these stories. And that's true, I think, when we read a lived or an imagined story that touches us deeply and makes us look at things a little differently. It also added to what I do believe. So let me say it both ways. I will forever be changed by having met the people that Leah wrote about in this story, that Bin from Vietnam arriving here with no shoes, that Elias and his family coming from Nigeria, from the most polluted places on the planet, polluted, by the way, by American oil industry. Manya, Louisa, these people are real human beings to me, fleshed out. Their stories are part of me. So I'm changed by it, by all of these stories. And also, the stories solidified something that is my true belief that I've uttered in various ways on this podcast over the nearly 5 years that I've been doing it. And that is this. There's so much in this world about which we can do so little. I can feel so powerless over the big problems that people face in this country, around the world. The political scene can feel overwhelming. And so what can I do? Can I give up my whole life and work toward a cause? If I do, then there's another cause that would be calling me too. So we do what we can. But I'll also say that I believe that since our stories are our most unique human quality, and sharing them is how we connect to one another, I believe that in sharing the true stories of people, that it can change hearts and mind, and that it can affect bigger things than just having read a good book. That it can affect how people treat one another, how we view each other, what people we vote for, and what policies they enact. That we can change the world by the telling of our stories. And Leah has done that in this book, Not From Here, as have so many of our guests telling their stories or the stories of other survivors, thrivers, innovators, glass ceiling breakers, and trailblazers. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Blurred Project. I'm grateful for your time, and thank you for listening.